sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
First quarter GDP estimates are cut. Just in, nada in Doha, and earnings season underway, investors breathing a sigh of relief. And not to forget our guest, a great one today, Ben Hunt. He's the author of Epsilon Theory, a weekly newsletter and website, as well as the chief risk officer at Salient Partners. All this and much more on episode number 459 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's tax time, April 15th, or maybe April 18th, depending on when you decide to file. April 15th being the usual date that we have to all put in those taxes, at least get in the payments, maybe do an extension. But this year, we had a couple of days extra due to some special holiday, and we were able to file on Monday, the 18th. So that's good news for some people. Lots going on around the world. We saw that last week, some interesting economics came in. I thought we'd talk about that a little bit today and also what's going on in the Middle East with regard to oil. But we did see that, yeah, GDP numbers for the first quarter of 2016 pretty much slashed down after there's been a whole slew of numbers that came in rather disappointing or just weak. Not seeing any significant rise in the outlook for GDP growth in the United States. In fact, kind of down to about 0.3-0.4% is the estimate here. Some of the reasons that we've been seeing is that industrial production and growth on the retail side has been rather subdued, to say the least. In fact, we saw that overall retail purchases fell about 0.3% in March. That was released earlier in the week last week. And even if we took out auto buying and auto purchases, they only rose about 0.2%. Now, compared to where they were expected to be, there was expected to be a gain on the headline number and also a plus 0.5% or plus 0.5% if we stripped out the auto numbers. So either way you want to look at those, there was a significant miss on the retail sales, which is really interesting because, again, we've been seeing that gas prices have been very low, as oil prices have dropped for some time now, and you would think that maybe consumers were starting to get a bit more excited about the opportunity to spend some money out there, but yet they're just not getting that, you know, that big recovery mode excitement going where somehow they're going out and purchasing items, big ticket or small ticket for that matter. Yeah, sure, we're seeing that some of the housing numbers have stabilized, and that's better. Credit expansion's a little bit better as well, but still, just the plain old vanilla retail sales numbers are just not doing great, even with all those extra people being added to the payrolls. So there's, again, that weird situation going on where we're seeing that while employment is doing a lot better, some of the other numbers underlying are just not really picking up along with it like you would expect it to be. Whatever the reason is, still not able to put our finger on it. Clearly, there's something going on behind the scenes, something that's happening that is quite invisible to the most, whether it's the underground economy of things like, maybe like the Ubers and maybe even gray market types of items that are being brought through. Maybe it's just the online buying that's going on, and maybe it's not, because of the price shopping availability, costs are lower. There's a lot of different possible things that are going on, but it doesn't make sense no matter how you slice it when we look at just simply the headline numbers. However, at the same time that we see that retail sales are slowing down, we also saw that the consumer sentiment index that was released from the University of Michigan for the first part of April came down to 89.7 from about 91 at the end of March. Now, a year ago, this was at about 95, almost 96. So we're down to about 89. Now, oftentimes what you do see, the preliminary numbers that are released first, they get revised a couple of times with the University of Michigan, and oftentimes they just simply move up a little bit. Very rarely do you see a big move, but we do see that the first numbers somehow are magically lower and they revise them up. I'm not sure what that's all about either, but must be something in their revision process that goes along with somehow people getting a little bit more excited. Maybe the people that they initially interview don't all come in with their best foot or something. I'm not sure what it is. But now at the same time, when we switch over to the other parts of the economy in the U.S., look at industrial production that was released last week. It dropped 0.6% in March, which was the same drop that we saw in February. And consumer prices, nothing. Rose only 0.1%. And the PPI, the producer price index, the wholesale manufacturing inflation gauge, not the finished products like we see on CPI or just a core inflation, that dropped also 0.1%. Now, meanwhile, we see that mortgages are the lowest when it comes to the 30-year in 3 years. The average rate on the 30-year loan right now is about 3.58%. That's pretty amazing. 10-year Treasury fell to 1.65% this month. Pretty amazing numbers here. So with that, you would expect some concern with the markets, but no. Nope, nope. Stocks rose. The S&P was up 1.6%. The Dow Jones Industrials were up 1.8%. And the NASDAQ was up 1.82%. Now, that was pretty much on the heels of some better-than-expected numbers, primarily from the banks last week. We saw that earnings season definitely began with the release from Alcoa. Saw a few numbers come in that week. Last week, though, was the big banks started to really play out. And we did see that J.P. Morgan, Citi, Bank of America did better on their earnings. There was some underneath the surface numbers that were a bit more concerning, as in we did see that earnings slowed down over the last year, and we've been seeing that earnings slow consistently. The trading revenues overall were pretty miserable, but we also saw that the level of loans that were souring in relation to the oil industry, the oil sector, was rising as well. But other than that, it seemed like the banks had a lot under control, considering the fact, realize, that there was very low expectations, a very low bar, and analysts really guided down and pegged their estimates extremely low. So the opportunity for banks to come over that bar was, again, pretty easy. Now, what's coming up this week? A lot of earnings this week. Really, this is a big week for earnings. Let me kind of just read off some of the things we'll see in earnings and economics over the next several days. Starting off the week, we have IBM, J.B. Hunt, Morgan Stanley, Netflix. Right there, we can stop with a big week already. Pepsi, Royal Caribbean, all announcing their earnings on Monday. We see also housing starts and building permits coming out on Tuesday. And earnings from Discover, Goldman Sachs, Harley Davidson, Intel, Johnson & Johnson, Yahoo, Philip Morris, United Health. And then on Wednesday, we're going to see existing home sales and earnings from American Express, Coca-Cola. Who else on this list that's exciting? United Rentals should be interesting. Yum Brands, who recently said they want to possibly sell off some of their Asia properties. Now, Thursday, we're going to see initial claims. It came in pretty light last week. I think it was 259 for the week last week. So initial claims, again, unemployment is really plowing ahead really very well and keeping on the same level of showing that the economy from an employment standpoint is extremely good. Again, if we just look at that one particular indicator as a barometer, it looks really good. We also have earnings coming out from Alaska Air and Google, or now known as Alphabet, Biogen, D.R. Horton in the housing area, General Motors, Microsoft, Norfolk Southern. We'll see about transportation, what's going on there. Pulte Group, another home builder, Schlumberger, which should be interesting from the area of oil services, Sherwin-Williams, Skechers, and Southwest Airlines. Starbucks will also be coming out on Thursday as well. Now, Friday, we're going to see earnings from American Airlines, AutoNation, Caterpillar, which a lot of people will be watching to see if those currency headwinds have abated at all, since we did see recently a 9% drop in overall valuation of a basket of currencies against the dollar. So we're going to see how that plays out with Caterpillar, even though they recently came out with a mid-quarter update, which looked pretty abysmal. Stock is holding up pretty well, though. GE also coming out, Honeywell, Kimberly-Clark, and McDonald's. So there's a lot there. A lot to take in, a lot for markets to take in. And again, we'll see how much of the recent move by the dollar has helped many of the companies that are on this list and whether or not they're still crying and whining about the outlook for the dollar and showing us currency constant or constant currency levels of the earnings that they have been doing for some time, or if the headwinds have turned into a bit of a tailwind over the last quarter and if their outlook is a little bit better. Again, we're going to be looking really at some of these companies for what their commentary is on the rest of the world. Of course, what they do in the United States is extremely important, but we want to find out what's happening with their outlook for the rest of the world. As we have seen recently, some of the chip companies have guided lower because of much of the slowdown they've seen in Asia. And if you noticed, on Friday, there was an interesting story that came out from Apple that said they're going to keep their production down because their inventories are still really high. They're not going to continue the significant increase of production because they're just not having those sales. And we've seen this before almost each and every quarter where Apple comes out with a comment that, you know, production is lower. We see many of the suppliers that are related to Apple in the industry of whether it's chips or the antennas or whatever it goes into the particular manufacturing of the iPhone start to fall off. And then all of a sudden, it's not such a big deal. And those stocks pop back. So I'm not sure if there's a game that's being played or if there is some truth in this. But the bottom line is it does look like there is a bit of a slowdown that is being told to us by Apple themselves. Story out Friday afternoon, and Apple stock came off about 1.5% or so. Nothing big, but still did slow down the advance on markets and create a little bit of a worrisome outlook for some of the industry. Now, our guest today I want to get to because brilliant guy, read his information. I think it's going to be a great discussion. So let's get right to that, and we'll come back and talk about oil. And our guest today is Dr. Ben Hunt, and he is the Chief Risk Officer of Salient. And it's an investment management firm with offices in Houston, San Francisco, and New York. And he's also the author of a fabulous weekly newsletter called Epsilon Theory. And it's also a website that examines markets through the lens of a game theory and history. It has about 50,000 subscribers, so you can check that out. So, Dr. Hunt, Ben, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for coming aboard. I have a lot of questions for you. You wrote a really fascinating piece recently that is entitled "My Passion is Puppetry." And what I thought, by the way, if you can pick this up out there, my listeners, I thought it started out really well because it had all the history or recent history of some of the commercials and the stars of those commercials for commercial property, casualty type of insurance from Mayhem and Flow. I didn't know that Flow went back to 2008, actually.
Yeah. 2008 was the birth of Flow.
Yeah, she's great. So, and obviously with Mayhem and all this, now you the whole point of this article was to look at the whole idea of, well, game theory, but also the idea of how people are, I guess, judging investments and how we're being advertised to in the world of investing, right?
Yeah, that's right. And there was a real sea change in the way in which property and casualty insurance was advertised, and it really started in 2008 with Nationwide launching the Flow commercials, where you can't go from channel to channel without stumbling on a Flow commercial.
Right.
And then, as you say, you know, it's picked up with the Mayhem guy for Allstate. Geico, of course, has been similarly. You know, they've had a number of very popular series of commercials, television commercials. You know, the Gecko goes back actually to 1999, but the really more humorous ones, you know, whether it's the the Hump Day camel or the Pinocchio saying, you know, you've got potential and you've got potential. These all started really in 2009. And, you know, you've got more recently.
Well, you can't leave off the Aflac duck.
The Aflac duck goes back a way as well, but you really get all of the property and casualty insurance companies launching these humorous campaigns, these entertaining 30-second spots for auto and home insurance. It really starts in 2008. And I know it's kind of an odd argument, but I don't think it's a coincidence that these campaigns for selling financial risk products began with the Great Recession. And I don't think it's a coincidence, I know it's not a coincidence, that the Federal Reserve's use of what they call communication policy advertising also began in late 2008, early 2009. It's the sort of thing that happens when fundamentals, right, whether it's the fundamentals of price and actuarial tables if you're in the P&C insurance world, or if you're in the investment world, the fundamentals of analyzing the cash flows of this company or the balance sheet of that company, when those fundamentals don't matter as much anymore, when the ground doesn't seem as steady beneath your feet, the very effective approach is to use these forms of narrative, of storytelling, of really more, I'll call it, entertainment-based advertising to get your point across, to get the consumer, in the case of someone watching a Geico commercial, to get the consumer to pay up for car insurance from that particular company. Or if you're the Federal Reserve, you put forward a narrative and a story and forward guidance to try to get people to go out farther on the risk spectrum in the securities they buy. It's exactly the same thing, just evidenced in different aspects of financial risk, and evidenced in a slightly different form for whether you're talking about, Pinocchio on a Geico commercial or Janet Yellen at a FOMC press conference.
You know, it's interesting because if you go way back, and I go back a bit, back in the day when information wasn't as readily available as it is these days, right? And you had to rely on either information next day, or I remember going to the library and picking through various periodicals, yes, right? And kind of like doing, yes, my research and coming up with all this before there was internet. And back in those days, and even back a little bit further, you had stockbrokers. Now, what would a stockbroker do? The stockbroker wouldn't call you up and say, hey, listen, Andrew, listen to me carefully. I got a stock that's got a positive cash flow. It's got a PE of 70 compared to the industry, blah, 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 mm-hmm, blah. And, look at the ROE on this thing and look at its growth. No, they wouldn't tell you that. They'd say, listen, mm-mm, I got a story to tell you about this company. This company's got some management team, and some of the management team does this and this and this. They got products in the pipeline. They got this going on here. And by the way, it looks like there could be, we're not sure about this, but an eventual buyout candidate here. Or even better, the story is about there's a drug company that's got a blockbuster in the pipeline, right? These are things that you couldn't prove, right? These are things that were just kind of used. But then all of a sudden we go into the next stage of stock research, which is now readily available. And you could find out all the information, all the numbers crunched. Now the data was all of a sudden very much out there. Now, whether mm-hmm, it was totally mm-hmm, accessible by you or not, still it was out there. We're back into the next thing, which is, hey, you know what? Put all that down. Let me just tell you the story. That's basically what's going on here. And we're finding that this is a gigantic story that is kind of like if you take two hands and put them up and here's the data, but don't look at that. Look over here. Look over here. Look over here.
Yeah. Right? No, it's exactly right. One of the first lessons I learned from the founder of one of the firms I started off with in the investment business was whatever role you might have in this environment, in markets, whether you're talking about financial, in all of financial services, whether you're on the buy side, the sell side, whether you're an analyst, whether you're a portfolio manager, you've got to be able to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it's no different from whether you're a stockbroker / salesman, where you've got to be able to tell a story. Or if you're an analyst or a portfolio manager, you've got to, the successful analysts are the ones who can tell a story, who can weave together the facts and figures into a coherent narrative,
right?
Tell that story to their portfolio manager. The successful portfolio manager is the one who can weave the facts and figures together in a coherent narrative to institutional investors. It's always your ability to tell a story, and what has changed, and I think it's in we can talk about the different drivers of this, one of which is clearly what you alluded to, that there is now transparency of the fundamental information, so that it's much more difficult to have a different or compelling story about, I don't know, the fundamentals of IBM, because, you know, all that data is there. And, I can look up and say, well, you know, I can weave together these facts and figures myself. What has changed, though, and this is very similar to actually what happened the last time we had a markets like we're seeing today, the 1930s, the conversation, the story, is led by what game theory calls missionaries. The story is led by people who have access to that public microphone. So it becomes, in these periods of where fundamentals don't matter very much for results, the storytellers become the politicians. The storytellers become the talking heads on TV. The storytellers become, and this is interesting, the central bankers. Mm. This has been a real change in the modus operandi for central bankers, that they are embracing the spotlight. They are embracing the microphone. And it's this is not by accident. So, you know, one of my favorite examples of this was Ben Bernanke's final speech, his valedictory address as Fed chairman. You know, essentially, you know, I find that these valedictory addresses, whether it's George Washington warning against foreign entanglements, or Dwight Eisenhower warning against the military-industrial complex,
right,
it's always these last speeches, I think, that are always quite telling. But Bernanke's last speech, he was saying, look, been here as Fed chair 8 years, I was like presided over the Great Recession and the debacle in the U.S. housing market, the U.S. financial system. And so let me tell you a little bit about you know, my experience and what worked and what didn't. He said, look, when I came into office, we really only had one toolkit, and that was our ability to lower interest rates on the short end, the Fed funds rate. And, you know, we quickly took that down to zero, and then we were stuck. Now, I'll come back to that, because other central banks have found ways to get unstuck even from the zero bound. But that first toolkit of lowering interest rates, you know, they got to zero, and then that was it. So he said, well, we had to devise a second toolkit, and that was quantitative easing. That was essentially making large-scale asset purchases, expanding the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. Sometimes it was actually buying assets. Other times it was extending the duration of those assets. But it's all of a course, really working on our balance sheet. And he said, you know, that we were pretty happy with how that worked with QE1. That in March of 2009, QE1 came online, and I agree with this. It was like putting a shot of adrenaline right into the heart, really, of global markets. But he said, you know, certainly we got diminishing returns from our subsequent efforts to buy stuff. So QE2, we felt like we got a little benefit in the real economy. By the time we got to QE3 and what we called QE Infinity, actually we seemed to be getting negative results in the real economy for this. So he said, well, so we had to come up with a third toolkit, and that toolkit is what they call communication policy. The use of words, the use of forward guidance, not in an effort to directly say what they're thinking, but to use the words for effect, to use the words themselves as a tool to try to change market behavior. And he said, look, this toolkit, this third toolkit, worked beyond our wildest dreams. And, you know, this is, I think, the real change we've seen in what it means to be a central banker over the last 10 years, is to embrace what politicians, frankly, have always done is to use their words for effect. And it really changes the whole nature of the conversation, the advertising, the stories that we listen to and we respond to as investors.
Well, not only that, I mean, listen, let's be honest with each other about this. It's threats, essentially threats that if markets don't do well, we're going to do something and scares the hell out of the people to get active in whatever they're doing. That's number one.
Absolutely right. It's entirely intentional. Intentional.
And the second thing is that it's also been a situation where they don't have as much tools to work with, and therefore they have to kind of keep on talking this whole game up. And the final thing is, by being as powerful as they are, because they have unlimited funds to do whatever the heck they want with. And you look at Japan, they actually buy equities in the market themselves. They own half of the ETFs in their market to begin with. China has been doing this for a long time to some, benefit and sometimes a detriment. But the fact is, we don't know what their next move is going to be and whether negative rates works or not, which is a whole different discussion. I have this big problem with negative rates.
For sure. Well, listen, let me stop you right there, because I want to give you one further, because what was most notable to me about what the European Central Bank did with their most recent announcement, this is the first weekend in March. The European Central Bank is now going to start buying corporate credit.
Yep.
This is an enormous change, right? So to date, the Fed has been in this boat too. We're just going to buy the equivalent of treasuries, right? And in the European context, they're buying sovereign debt. Now the U.S. loosened this up a bit now and say, well, we're going to start buying mortgage backed securities.
Right.
Now Europe is saying we're going to start buying investment grade corporate credit. Look, so it's you're absolutely right. I love your analogy of talking about you're playing the game with somebody who's got an unlimited balance sheet. I liken it to sitting down, and I think a lot of your listeners are probably poker players. What's changing now is that we're now sitting down at the table with someone who's got an unlimited stack of chips.
Right.
And so it becomes very difficult to participate today in as a trader or an investor in European corporate credit markets, because the ECB may sit down at that table and their stack of chips is a lot bigger than yours. I don't care who you are, they've got a bigger stack. And if they want to bulldoze their way through the table, if they want to pay $1.20 for something that's worth 70 cents, you can't short it. You can't fight that.
Isn't a
change.
Isn't the problem that therefore price discovery is very difficult? This is why we see...
It's impossible. It's not difficult. It's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing is, by the way, just to get back to the commercials for a second, I remember years ago when commercials were on TV or on the radio, and you see signs like, for example, you drive along the road and you see this sign in this, small little town, world's best hamburger. Like, really? Now, me? I'm like, oh, come on. I know that's stupid. Let's put the, is there actually a world's best hamburger? Maybe. Is it probably here? Not so probable. And who's rating them and who's regulating that sign anyway? The problem is, though, because the way that advertising has become, and by the way, the newest line of where advertising, it's news, but it's advertising, but they bake it in, make it look
the infomercial.
Yeah, but there's something else they call it. Gosh, I'm forgetting the name here, but it's basically where the advertisement is an article. It's an advertisement disguised as an article.
Native advertising. Yeah.
The problem is that this generation and younger people were never in a situation where they didn't see this kind of thing. So they believe this is believable. All this is believable. And they're like, my son, it's the best hamburger. You got to stop there. I'm like, well, why? Well, it's the best hamburger in the world. I'm like, no, that's probably, it's possible. Then you start thinking to yourself, well, maybe it is. But this is the problem we have, that whether we become very gullible, whether you've done such a great job on this, or as you've mentioned, where right now, where we see that the Fed, for example, or the ECB has so much power and sitting at that poker table, and they can have nothing and I can have three aces in my hand, And they keep on just blowing me out and blowing me out.
Bidding it up. Yeah.
And I can't stay up with it. And I'm not, you know, gosh knows what they have. I don't know what they have. But the point is that it makes it very difficult because when you look at the fundamentals, that's, as you mentioned, that's not really what's going on here, because we're seeing that fundamentals are slipping. We're seeing that companies that, you know, just look at the materials companies recently, or even the oil companies. Now, there are times that things fall out of bed, of course. You know, things, you know, go a little haywire. But at the same time, all they have to do is step in again and say, well, we changed our mind. We're going to, you know, we were going to raise rates. We're not going to raise rates now. Then you have this other issue. Whereas recently, I think you've mentioned in this article that, you know, it's very difficult to be a stock picker per se, because, you know, there is the desire to understand the fundamentals and have the best companies that should be the players, that should be the ones that outperform, may not necessarily be so, because if you have so much liquidity in the markets, it just, you know, bids up all the crap. And maybe what you do is you do a different kind of discussion and you just start bidding up all the heavily shorted securities. And so what's happening is that active managers are losing. As a matter of fact, Tudor Jones just lost $1 billion. You're seeing that pension plans are pulling out of the hedge funds they've had for years.
Yep.
Because they're not, quote unquote, keeping up with the market. We're like, wait a minute, that wasn't supposed to keep up with the market. That wasn't the game. You changed the game. Everybody, the game now is to be the market. And now what's happened is more and more money is flowing into ETFs. And I want your opinion on this. Has the massive move into ETFs distorted the market process?
The short answer is yes and no. So here's what I mean by that. The distortion here is that everything now is a casino chip. And what I mean by that is that when you're buying an ETF is a, you know, let's use this nasty word, derivative. Look, I love derivatives. I make my business with you know, derivative strategies and the like. But it is often, I'm also a big believer in calling things by their proper name.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're buying an ETF, you're not buying a stock in the way, you know, people think the meaning of the word stock is. You're not buying a fractional ownership share of this real-world company making a real-world thing or providing a real-world service and possessing a real-world cash flow. You're just not. You're buying a, again, I like to use the word, you know, casino chip, because you are participating, you're playing the game of public markets. And it just has a very different meaning than what public markets used to mean. And what private markets, frankly, still mean, where you're thinking, okay, I'm buying that fractional ownership share of a real world company and a real world cash flow. So that's the change. Now how does it not change things? Look, just because, you know, we've got a lot of money going into ETFs, it doesn't make them, you know, inevitably some sort of levered thing that will inevitably collapse, right? It's just a different game. It's not necessarily a flawed game, but you have to understand what it is you are doing when you're buying an ETF. You know, I'll give you a quick example. You should never set a stop loss on an ETF.
Yeah.
Because it does not act like a stock, like a company. It is a derivative representation, and I will tell you, and you saw this a lot last summer, you know, if you get even a slight blip in the pricing of an exchange-traded fund, it is a derivative instrument, you know, you're going to get stopped out, and you're going to be very disappointed when 10 minutes later the price has rebounded, but it's been sold away.
Unless you're smart enough to play the game of, I'm just going to wait around all day for some wild price action and put a bid way below to buy or sell on the upside. You can do that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can do that. But oftentimes when those sort of shocks happen, the exchange will come in and undo the trade.
Of course. Well, especially if it's in our favor.
Today is tremendous.
You know, it's like...
Never.
I'll tell you a quick story. So there's trade errors. You know, you got to bust a trade.
Yeah.
Okay, in my career, I think I remember one time that when I busted a trade, it went in my favor. Once. Right. And then when it goes in your favor, by the way, you can't keep the money.
Very true.
You know?
Very true.
So this whole game theory, the puppet masters, and I mean, obviously it sounds like, you know, oh, you're angry about, not you, but both of us here, you're angry about something here. But is this, you know, this, you mentioned IBM earlier, you know, and the thing about IBM, which is interesting, is we've seen, I don't even know how many consecutive quarters of declining revenue. Company is kind of, you know, getting uglier and uglier by the day. We know that the companies are involved in, don't worry about that because look at our EPS. It's doing much better. And we're, quote unquote, beating analysts' expectations. One of the ways they do that is by massive share repurchases. And I don't know how they don't run out of money these days, but I guess it's because of the low interest rate environment.
Money's free.
Yeah, money's free. Yeah. Exactly. So they keep on doing this and they keep on bringing up the EPS. And still, you know what? To this day, generally speaking, I don't think anybody has really challenged the whole in a meaningful way. The idea that, you know, companies, if you would have taken away the share repurchases, their earnings would stink. And why is nobody fighting this?
Well, they're fighting it because the stock, you know, most stock purchases result in the share price going up. Look, I remember when I was, you know, running my hedge fund, there were some companies that would do stock buybacks, and I applauded it, right? Because if you are growing organically and the best use of your funds is now to concentrate your earnings into a smaller share count, I'm all for it as an investor.
Right.
What you found so many times, though, is that whatever shares were being bought back on the one hand were being handed out with the other hand in the form of options or restricted stock grants. So, you know, you've got to pay a lot of attention to that about whether management is giving away with one hand in terms of the share count while taking away on the other hand. But I think what it's really indicative of is that, you know, whether you're talking about investors or you're talking about management teams, we are easily trained, and we are easily trained to participate in what works to make us more money. And if that means borrowing, not to buy plant or equipment or to pay higher salaries or to grow our business, but instead to simply buy back stock and be rewarded in that sense, as most management teams have been, then that's what we're going to do. If we are rewarded as investors to follow along, to say, great, I'll believe that emperor, you know, is wearing a fine suit of clothes if it's going to make me more money, that's the rational thing to do. And unfortunately, these things work until they don't, and it's finding those tipping points that's the bane of a rational investor's existence.
So just to kind of bring this all together, if we've gone from a period some time ago that investment fundamentals mattered, and you know, concentration by analysts and by investors was focused on, you know, the quality of the earnings and all the other metrics that are important in terms of a stock, let's say, and markets, into some kind of storytelling, and then into even, I guess, obfuscation of the facts. So
without a doubt.
You know, kind of look over here, look at left field when the ball's coming to right field concept, right? You know, kind of, hey, watch my hand, watch my hand, and watch my left hand, and then boom, you get punched with the right hand. When and if does this ever cycle? It's going to cycle to something. You know, we do see the cycles, or at least transitions. Does it ever get back to fundamentals? I mean, I can't see the Fed ever getting out of this anymore. I mean, I can't see the central banks of the world getting out of. I really can't see them getting out of the hole they dug themselves into.
Here's what changes things, and the change will not come from the inside, right? And by the inside, I mean markets. Period. The change always comes from outside. It always comes from domestic politics shifting dramatically, so that the entire role of a central banker, the role of markets changes in a society or a country. Now, look, a lot of times that change isn't positive, right?
Yeah, right.
I would love to say, okay, we're going to have a realigning election, or we're going to have change in domestic politics so that growth policies are adopted in the real economy, so that we move towards politics of growth rather than politics of identity.
Right.
But I got to tell you, I'm not holding my breath. But that's the sort of thing that has to happen in one form or another. The domestic political shock has to occur before the central banks are essentially forced to adapt and play a different role in markets.
You know, I'll just close on this. You know, one of the things that after, we'll call it the 2007 through 2009 breakdown, the terrible situation that happened, not with housing, but markets and people with their jobs and all that, I had hoped back then that because I saw so much of concentration back in the early 2000s of everybody just focusing about this stock or that stock with the bubbles, but then after the bubble broke with the NASDAQ, quickly everybody started coming back to the whole trading idea and all that, and it got out of hand again, and then it broke down again. But I was hoping that a little bit of humility would be... I was hoping that just a little humility about, you know what, this is a fragile environment. You know, everybody's here to make money and do what we can and build our futures and all the good things that go along with it. I'm not talking fairy tale land here. I'm just talking about, you know, back to a little bit of common sense and humility and all that. And it took like 5 minutes for that to, you know, happen and then just go right away.
Vanish, right?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's so true. When you look at it, they had all the central bank chairs of at a conference.
New York. It was in New York. It was at the house, the something house.
International House. Yep. And what I'll tell you is, you know, you look, has there ever been such smugness, right? The rarest thing in the world today is authenticity.
Yep.
And boy, that's we could sure use a heavy dose of it now, but I just don't see where it's going to come from.
Well, I think the next Epsilon theory should focus on authenticity and humility. That could be something.
I love that. You know? I love that idea.
There you go. I want to thank you for joining us. We're about out of time here. So listen, everybody, we'll have the information on Ben Hunt and on Salient Partners, as well as how to check out and read and subscribe to the Epsilon Theory weekly newsletter on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
I thought that was a pretty cool discussion. I think that the whole idea of the puppetry and the obfuscation and how the advertisement industry has infiltrated now, or at least maybe they haven't infiltrated, but the central banks and many of the players and politicians are so in tune with what we want to hear and how to play us. Really, that's what we're talking about, right? How they play us, how they have a carrot in front of us and allow us to move in the direction that they're moving by kind of just constantly putting out the idea that, hey, something in the future is going to change, or hey, just watch out for this, or, you know, keep on looking over here. That's really the story, and that's what's been going on. As a matter of fact, we can kind of relate that, as I mentioned before we got to Ben in this discussion, with the whole thing that went on in Doha. Now, Doha is in Qatar, and about 16 or so different oil ministers from around OPEC and non-OPEC got together. This is a meeting that was exciting and something that was going to tell us a little bit more about the intentions of OPEC, because if you remember, there has been an incredible build on oil inventories for some time. And if just simple supply and demand we look at, well, oil should be what the price is currently. But if, of course, we see that things like production will be limited, and if there's going to be an actual production drop of some sort, if that was to occur, or maybe demand increased, well, the simple supply-demand equation will change, and therefore we should see that the opportunity for oil pricing to move higher will exist. The other opportunity is we do see, just like we talked about with Ben, the last several weeks, the whole idea was that there's going to be a production freeze. Now, that's not a production cut. We're not going to be confused by this, although there is something about markets being a little bit confused by this, because oil came back about, I don't know, 40% from its lows recently on the idea that, well, you know, between the rig counts on a weekly basis that are showing a drop, and even though inventory builds on Wednesdays when we see the numbers come out have been pretty significant, demand is not increasing, there still is the opportunity for Saudi Arabia and Russia to lead the way to try to get some kind of production freeze. I'm not sure how a production freeze would actually give us any kind of benefit, because when you look at the current level of production, what we're seeing currently, which is very high, and the fact that oil inventories are continuing to build, there is no change in the dynamic of the supply and demand. We'd have to see actually a production cut. But I think markets were saying that, you know, if in fact we can get these oil ministers together and we can get OPEC and non-OPEC together and agree, at least if nothing else, not to increase production any further, then at least there's a chance that things could stabilize. And maybe it was the underpinning of the potential for a production cut sometime in the future. I think that was what really the overriding discussion that was being heard by investors. And therefore, many of the short sellers started to cover. And as they started to cover, oil prices shot up. And we did see a couple of weeks ago a number that came out on inventories that was actually a draw of about 4.5 million barrels. And that excited everybody, saying, wait, maybe demand is coming up a little bit. Maybe production slowing down a little bit. We saw the rig count come down each and every week consistently over the last year or so. And we did see it come down. And therefore, again, putting this into the same discussion, maybe there's a change in the supply-demand dynamic that's going on. Not to mention the fact that everybody was looking forward to this meeting that was going to happen on Sunday, April 17th, where they all got together and they were going to agree on production cuts or production freezes. Well, leading into the meeting, let me give you a little bit of backstory here. Leading up into the meeting, Iran was saying, okay, well, maybe we'll talk about this. Well, as we got closer and closer to the meeting, there was no longer a main player, the chief oil minister that was going to attend the meeting from Iran, but a junior member. That was the story going into the weekend. Well, that wasn't so exciting. People got a little bit disappointed with that because obviously a junior minister, if you will, couldn't make a decision and sign a document decree. So that was kind of already concerning. As we got towards the weekend, the announcement was made that Iran will not be participating in this meeting at all. They're not sending anybody. What the heck? Well, that sent a signal. Then we hear in the background before this all started, before the meeting actually went into session, that Saudi Arabia said that, you know what, we will be happy to do a production freeze, but it has to be unanimous with all countries. And if Iran's not going to cut, you know what, let me tell you something. We can actually increase our production. We can increase our production significantly, if not even double it within a year. Now, I don't know why they said that. If they're trying to come into this deal and at least have a reasonable level of trust amongst all the others, and I'm not sure what this bluff would have done, except for scare the hell out of some of these players, because if they don't do a freeze, then oil is going to be flooding onto the market and prices are going to plummet again, causing all these countries to have much more problems than they have currently. Now, Saudi Arabia can do a little bit more than others with low oil prices, but yet some of these countries are really in bad shape when it comes to reliance on just pricing of oil, or primarily the pricing of oil, and that can be a big problem. So Saudi Arabia is saying, you know what, hey, just to let you know, we're not really inclined to do any kind of cuts if Iran is going to not abide by this or even come to this meeting, or if they're not going to even say, for the cameras, if you will, that they will, yeah, abide by some kind of production freeze at these levels. Iran wants to get back in the game. You know, we lifted these sanctions on them recently, and they need to get back in the game in order to fill their coffers back up because they've been limited by their production for years. And as such, their country is in bad shape financially. They're really not willing to do, they're like, what the heck? And we want to get back some of our overall production so that we can gain back some of the money that we lost over the years. Well, anyway, long story short, wouldn't you know it? By the end of the meeting, it ended. No deal. No deal. Nothing on the table. Even some kind of discussion about how they would possibly do some kind of production freeze out to October and then maybe talk about cuts. Now the problem is going to be, what's going to happen moving forward? How are they going to hold that carrot out that they may in fact do some cuts or even production freezes or anything in the future to limit the amount of oil that's being pushed on the markets and sent into inventories, and therefore hold up the pricing? Because really the game at the end of the day is all about holding up the price of oil. And if we saw this massive move up into this meeting because of all the rhetoric and conversation that was being put out there, the carrot, if you will, like we talked about with Ben, the puppetry. You know, the look here, look here, look here. Forget about the fundamentals. Look over here. We're talking about something that may be beneficial long term, and that look over here has just disintegrated. What's going to happen? I would venture to say that oil prices are not going to be too happy, initially at least. Now, even unless we see some kind of change to the dynamic on a weekly basis of inventory builds, if maybe we start seeing, you know, maybe some builds less than 3 million barrels a week, which is still a lot. Iran not pumping up the production. Saudi Arabia just kind of hanging tight. And rig counts coming down each and every week here in the United States. Well, that could do something to help support the price of oil. However, it does seem to me that the OPEC and non-OPEC nations cannot get their act together, and Iran isn't budging. And if Iran doesn't budge, and even if all these other players put in a production freeze, and Iran says, oh, that's great. That's great. You know what? Thank you. We're going to just double our production here because we need to get back into the game and get back into leadership in the area of oil production because we, again, want the money from this somehow. Whoever is buying this, you know, even though it's going into inventories and building of inventories, but maybe some of the players out there will want to use Iran's oil. Maybe Iran will say, you know what, we'll drop the price a little bit and we'll allow you to pay a little bit less than the going rate here so that you use us rather than them. A lot of nastiness happening. The bottom line is we'll have to see how this plays out with the rest of the market. There was some decoupling of the price of oil to the markets over the last couple of weeks, something we haven't seen in approximately 6 or 7 months, as oil was leading the way in terms of overall market volatility and direction. As went oil, we knew for a while, so did markets. Last couple of weeks, that split up a little bit, and I think that had a lot to do with the anticipation of this meeting that was happening over this weekend in Doha. So now we can just take it and just throw it out the window, though, can't we? I mean, just take it and just whoop, gone. So we'll see what happens here when oil opens up and trades on the exchange, not the electronic trading, which could be disastrous, by the way. Very thinly traded overnight, starting at 6 p.m. each and every night. The futures open up, except for the weekends, although on Sunday nights, they open up at 6. We'll have to see what happens with oil and how that plays out in the electronic trading. But when it does open up in pit trading tomorrow on Monday, it should be a very interesting situation where a lot of people were betting on the fact that there will be at least some kind of reasonable level of agreement or consideration between all the countries. And that just, like I said, blew up in the end there. The other thing I want to mention is that there's been some continued discussion about what's going on in Japan and China. And there's an interesting chart that I was looking at just today about even though China had been talking from the beginning of the year about how they'll keep their currency stable, ever so slowly it's been drifting lower against the basket of currencies and in particular against the U.S. dollar. And just ever so slowly moving lower and lower, even though they look to have tried to sustain some of that from their major move lower in August where they devalued because a lot of that came back for a while. And in Japan, the problem is that the yen has been backfiring on the plans by Shinzo Abe and his plan to move into negative interest rates. And with the negative interest rates, the idea was to really cut that currency pretty hard and it reversed on them. And in fact, the same thing occurred with Europe. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, of course, the U.S. Fed came in and kind of counterattacked and said, you know, we just can't have the dollar this low for much longer. So we're going to keep an eye on those currencies as well. But it would stand to reason that if we don't see any kind of major pickup in the drifting lower for the dollar, you know, it does stabilize here. And we do see a little bit of a reversion off these bottoms right now. It did see a little bit of a move higher towards the end of the week last week, that they could spill some further trouble for the emerging markets, particularly if this oil situation really starts to implode due to the fact that there is no production cuts or any kind of agreement at all with OPEC and non-OPEC. So that's something to really keep an eye on right now and something to, I think, watch as an area of concern because that could spill over into the rest of the markets. And that trend that we saw recently over the last 6 weeks or so that really has been pinned on the reversal and the move of oil off of those bottoms and the hope that much of the problems with the energy sector have been not totally resolved, but at least stabilized. The problems that we saw with the junk bonds, the problems we saw with their balance sheets, the problem we saw with their earnings, and the fact that there was no end in sight with oil falling for such a long period of time, especially as it dropped sharply into the mid part of February. But that all started to heal a little bit, and the markets really took notice of that and said, you know what? Well, at least we have that stabilizing, and that's a helpful situation. Again, we're going to have to see if that oil trade starts to link up again, if in fact oil starts falling back. And we have some way on a technical basis for oil to move. So I think those are the real key things that we need to look at, along with much of the earnings that we're going to see coming out next week. Of course, we do have some Fed speakers. As a matter of fact, there is a parade on Monday and Tuesday. And then towards the end of the week, Mario Draghi is going to come out with another interest rate decision. And we do know that he has in the past been moving markets. The last couple of times, though, much of his conversation that he had where he is going to do everything that's possible and really pressed on the negative rate side of things backfired in terms of the euro, and the banks over there just look absolutely awful. You haven't looked at Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank as two key banks in the euro area. Take a look. Their prices are back to 2009 levels. And that's not something that's really very exciting to really consider with the idea that things are better now and a very accommodative central bank in Europe. Anyway, lots of things to consider. I really encourage you to check out and to, you know, see and read the information by our guest today, Ben Hunt. I find him not only entertaining, but smart as a whip. And I find his information just to be very thought-provoking, and I think you will too. Check it out over on the Epsilon Theory website of Salient Partners, and you can find that over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes of this particular episode. And you can find lots more information there as well, how to follow Ben on Twitter, how to follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is my handle. Epsilon Theory is Ben's handle on Twitter. And of course, you can find out all the other information about how we manage money, how we do what we do, what we do for clients, etc., over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, thanks for joining me. Any questions you have, send them off to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you soon. Thanks again.
Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.